The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Right, I'm delighted to say we're talking with Bernard Brogan about his new book. It's called The Hill and it's in all good bookshops now. It's really good. And it's the first opportunity we've ever had to see inside the Dublin dressing room from the Jim Gavin era. So that must have been a big enough decision for you to go, I'm going to tell the truth about what happened and reveal what goes on.
Well, what I wanted to do was tell my journey along and my challenges and also highlight some of the amazing individuals that made my journey so amazing. I obviously wanted to be respectful of the dressing room. That team is still in pursuit of a six in a row and still in pursuit of All-Irelands, and a lot of them will be around for years to come. So I didn't want to give away anything too major, but I felt it was I could, especially with Jim moving away and it'd been a total new dressing room, new management.
Did that really help, actually?
Absolutely, yeah. I know nothing what's happening in the dressing room now. I don't ask any questions on purpose because obviously I was writing the book. But
like one of the final scenes is you sitting down with Jim to tell him you're retiring, and you've no clue at that stage. You're kind of talking to him about what next year's going to be like, and it sounds like he hadn't quite made up his mind at that point. 6 weeks later, he announces, and you're like, whew, I can write everything now.
Yeah, not that it, you want to be respectful. And that group was successful because of its unity, and it's kept itself to itself. And how much did that mean to the success? Who knows? There's a lot of different variables that drive success, but I wanted to be respectful of that. But I think when you do something special like that, and obviously I was heavily invested in that, and I felt like there was a story there to be told, you know.
There's a million different stories to be told. Each of the individuals who are there,
everyone has their own story, you know what I mean? And my one is about challenges. It's an angle into the dressing room from my point of view. That's probably different to a lot of people's because especially the last couple of years, I only played 5 minutes twice. You know what I mean? So it's not the same mindset or the same environment that maybe a young lad had, like a Conor Callaghan would have, or Kieran Kilkenny or Brian Fenton, that are driving the energy, you know. So mine is a different mindset and a different view, but a view.
Yeah, totally. And that's why we started with the Kerry stuff previously, was because that's the stone on which the sword gets sharpened. It's these defeats where, one, you think you're really close to them and it's like, oh look, we're really close, and then they're just a buzzsaw and they cut you off the next time, and all of a sudden you've got to go back to the drawing board. You said something there about our success is a lot of variables. Sport is so random. There's a game where Mayo scored 2 on goals in an All-Ireland final and ends in a draw. Like, you know, when you think back on all the stuff that you did that year as a team and as a group, and all the meetings and the people who came and spoke to you and the mindfulness and all that stuff, like, it's so random.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that says it all. You say it there. And sometimes for that success, you need luck. And you need, like Mark talked about, when we got over the line in 2011, we were a different team coming into it, and we were different. If Kerry had won that, we'd be looking back and saying, God, we weren't good enough, we hadn't done this, we hadn't done that. Like, it's easy to applaud the efforts of a team that's successful, but yes, you have to put yourself in the position and have to be prepared to get over the line, but along that journey there's a lot of different variables. Once you cross the white line, as Jim said, let me see if I can get this right, is the all preparation for war, I won't get this right, but basically when you cross the white line, all your preparation of war goes out the window, because once you meet the enemy, it's all up in the air, and it's whatever happens, whatever way the ball
no
falls.
No plan survives the first sortie against the enemy.
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes.
That's
more eloquently said. Jim won't be happy now with that effort. But
The prodigal son makes an appearance here at just the precise right moment as well. So for people who are kind of unfamiliar with the details, you do your cruciate in February of 2018. So and get back just for the end of that championship and decide to come back for 2019. And you're having very robust conversations with Jim Gavin towards the end of the season. At various stages, these conversations feel like this could be the end. It's like there's this kind of, which ratchets up the tension a good bit. But the prodigal son makes an appearance here. I actually love the parable because it doesn't make any sense to me, right? When you think about the prodigal son, is you can go off and have all the crack, do whatever it is, spend all the family's money, you go and play football in Boston if you want to, and then you come back and there's a party for you and the fatted calf. It's always the people who are left at home. How does this parable make you, what It makes me want to party when I hear that part, right? That's why that's...
What did it mean for me?
Well, no, I think, like, you were right to be pissed off, weren't you?
Yeah, well, like, here, I, as you said, I was fighting with my fingernails to get back into that team in 2018. Did my cruciate, came back in record time. I think I was back on the pitch within 4 months, 4.5 months. I came on against Roscommon for a couple of minutes, but threw a blood sub, I just about got on. After five and a bit months, you know, and then didn't see any more action for the rest of the year, I decided to come back and asked that if I come back, I know I'm probably down a pecking order, this team is an amazing team, but I want the opportunity to play if I get myself to the level that I need to be. And throughout the year, I wasn't really getting there, and yeah, I suppose why I was annoyed is that, like, I was working hard, I was there, I hadn't gotten a chance, hadn't proved right or wrong my theory or Jim's theory about, I say in the book, the Kerry game in 2000, and it was until 2017, when I said that four balls on top of my head, and it was like Jim just decided I'm no longer a starter anymore for this team, I'm just too old, or I'm just...
That's the league final.
Yeah, league final, yeah, which... Genuinely, their balls were kicked over my head. You know what I mean? I didn't play well, but it wasn't all my fault. So I was trying to come back. I said to Jim at the start of the year, and Jason and all the management team, I want to be a 50-minute man. I know I'm not going to start for you. I don't have 60, 70 minutes in the belt, in the tank. I'm going to get. I'm going to hone my kicking, and I'm going to be. If I get two shots, I'm going to score two of them. If I get one shot, I'll put the ball over the bar. I was building myself for a certain situation, and I just felt.
Like, what did they say to that?
They were like, yeah, I like that. I said, like, you know you're going to come up against something. We're going to come up against a team. We're not going to have it all our own way. 2018, we kind of got over the line relatively easy. You know what I mean? There was no major stress around it. 2019, I said, this is not going to just fall in your lap. I said, you're going to need some left to centre, some solutions. I said, that's what I'm hoping to be for you. And that was all positive, and off it went. And then just as the year went on, I just felt I wasn't getting, and I was getting frustrated, and then you're not playing well in training. And
you didn't see any much league time in 2019?
I saw 5 minutes against Cavan, and I got blocked, and just was like, just I came into the game frustrated. I came into the game positive, because I was told I was going to get game time. Got 5 minutes, frustrated on the bench before I came on, then got the nod, warmed up, frustrated, got on. Yeah, and you get blocked and you end up frustrated. So I was literally at the end of the league, I was more or less throwing the hat at it. But I got Gary Keegan, actually, our sports psychologist, just really did a session and just hit me right between the eyes that it's not all about me, it's about the group, it's about self, and it's about what you can add. Can you add to this group? And he wasn't pointed at me, it was a group session, but it just really, as if he was just chatting to me. And I said, right, line the sand, I said, I'm just going to roll with this. I said, I'm probably not going to play much football, but I'm going to get in and do my best. And I felt I got to a level. And then, obviously, Dermot came back in. And Jim, I presume, was just wanting to have all of his bullets in his gun coming into an All-Ireland final. And Dermot's one of my good mates. He's here. I played in the wing with him for 10 years, week in, week out. And we worked well together. And we got good pals, play golf and drink pints and all that. But and it wasn't about that. It was more about the management not showing respect, or just not showing me the opportunity, and me feeling as in that means that I'm just down another rung in the ladder, that I'm not going to get my chance, which was the case. So
you talk about respect, and you actually open that kind of worms with Jim. Is like you respect me as a man, but you don't respect me as a footballer. And there's a pause, and he's like, well, I do, but you basically were saying he's not showing it to you. By our words.
Yeah, and probably enough, looking back, like, I'd say the fundamentals, and I fight my corner and had some robust chats, which Jim always welcomes because he wants people to show that they care and that they're actually going to go out and get something. So Jim wouldn't want me to apologise for having robust conversations with him. He encourages it, but I definitely feel that looking back, the manager probably just said he's probably just like someone who doesn't play, like number 30 on the pitch. They look at and go, lovely lad, he's on the team, he's there, but he's probably not going to play, and he's just maybe not good enough. And maybe that was, looking back, that's probably the way they felt, you know what I mean? But if I believed that, what was the point of being there, you know what I mean? I didn't believe it. I believed that I could add value, and I could get onto the pitch and help the team.
You were never going to make the decision for them. You were never going to step away and say, I've had enough here.
Like, I think everyone has a right to leave and retire when they want. I wanted to be around. I felt I was good enough to be around. I obviously was coming back from a cruise ship. I said, I'm going to get myself in such nick that I'd be able to add something to this team in a year that there's going to be banana skins along the way. And I fundamentally felt, is this team better with me in the group or without me in the group? And I weighed that it was better to have me there, being right or wrong, but that was my belief, and that's why I stuck around. And yeah, I wasn't going to walk away once I kind of got that clarity in my head, that session with Gary Keegan. I was staying around.
And there's loads of examples in the book about the culture of how that actually has an impact, and you can help the person you're marking directly in training who comes and says, well, you know, how did you do that against me? Or talking to Paul Mannion about his game, all that kind of stuff as well, which would suggest that the culture is very healthy. Do you feel like you were held to a different standard from other people, a higher standard, because for any reason, like, one, because you'd reached such great heights, two, maybe because you did commercialise your brand at a point when it was not the done thing in GAA. Did you feel that actually was something that ever entered into someone's mind when they were making decisions about the team or whatever?
I would say there was potentially an unconscious bias there. Definitely an unconscious bias. Where there's a conscious bias, I'm not sure. But definitely that, obviously, I'd been around a long time. Jim knew exactly how I could play the ball when I played well, the way I played, when I played bad, what the signs were, as the JO, as the deck, all of the management team. So when I'm going out and trying to prove myself in a match, in a 15v15, if I could get onto the team, onto it, for me, I score 4 points, and that's great, and Burns moving well, and there he is. So that's seen, and this is my view, this seen by a management, or I would see it as well when I watch my club or watch any match, when somebody does what they're meant to do or plays well. If someone else does something similar down the other end of the park, there's a younger guy clipping 3 or 4 points, you know what I mean?
Get him in and see what he can do in the match.
Like, when you weigh them up, like, yeah, where do you want to go, and age, and been around, and all the baggage that goes with been around for a long time and a bit older, and not that I don't think it was ever conscious, I don't think, but definitely it's human nature to feel that way, you know what I mean?
Coaches will view it as like, you might be an opportunity blocker, this guy could be the next Bernard Brogan, who the current Bernard Brogan is actually.
I definitely felt that was the case along the journey of the 5 in a row, that like, I'm going to empower somebody. I would feel that it was, I'm going to empower a young guy over Bernard who mightn't be here next year or could get injured. But as I said to Jim at the start, I said, whether that happened or not in the past, where decisions were made because I was a bit older or not, I said, this is the year, this is the pinnacle. So if I come back, just if I'm good enough to play and the young guy is as good as me and I'm playing a little bit better, you play me.
Yeah.
You afford me the same opportunity you would anyone else.
Yeah.
And that's the cultural piece that Jim brought into the team, and so that was my view of it. Yeah.
You talk about the commercialism as well, and how you've been part of a generation who have changed how GAA players are marketed, and how you've taken control of that as much as you possibly can, and like every sport in the world has gone through this. Literally every sport in the world has gone through this. So we're a bit behind the curve in Ireland, and I think anybody calmly and coldly would rationalise that the right thing to do is to do this, is to continue to market the sport and to make as much money from sponsors as we possibly can. And Pat Gilroy had set up a players' trust so that everybody got a taste of it. Did you ever feel, though, that you suffered as a result of that?
I'd say the way people looked at me, I definitely suffered, or their perception of me definitely was viewed in a way due to that. I felt that the GAA is the most grassroots, is the most powerful organisation in this country, and brands and sponsors want to be aligned to it because it has such a value set that the brands and sponsors want to be aligned to. And what better than an amateur sports person who gives his heart and soul to something that is for the good of his community and representing his family and parish. So there's nowhere better in the world for a sponsor to live or for a brand to be associated with, because it's such a pure sport. And because Dublin were on a certain trajectory and I was a forward with that team, I was a natural choice for some of these brands, you know what I mean? And I got behind it because I'm an entrepreneur, I'm commercially minded anyway, but I also felt it's the right thing to do, was that, like, why shouldn't a player who was giving their like the rugby lads down the way get paid a
fortune? Exact same thing, yeah.
And they get paid and they get their
sponsorship. This is Ireland, brothers, you can't do it.
But, yeah, you're right, as in people always begrudge that amateur is pure and amateur should be amateur. But, like, we're all trying to get after it. They want us to entertain them on our final day, but then they don't want you to reap the rewards of building a brand or going on a journey that a brand might want to partner with you. And yeah, I meet a lot of pushback at times from people, but I think that it's the right thing to do, and I encourage all GA players to get involved, and the GPA has supported those views, and sponsors as well. They want
players. Well, it's exploded since, like, not even since, like, that, you know, you weren't the only person doing this. There was loads of people doing it at the time, but it has become a science. Did it ever feed into selection at any point, or was there ever? So 2016 is kind of the king of the hill appears, and I wonder what that experience for you was like, seeing turning around the corner from Clonliffe onto John's Road and go, well, that's okay, that's me, you know, yeah. I'm there.
I'm trying to find the bus route to keep off the poster off the wall. So that was one of the terms and the conditions, was that when the bus was driving down, they didn't see me saying King of the Hill on it, which is obvious, for obvious reasons, didn't want that, but.
Because of the slagging, or because you thought it was more than just slagging?
Well, I don't, like, fundamentally, like, I wasn't any bigger than any player in that team. I wasn't more important than any player in that team. And I genuinely felt that. Like, I didn't feel like I was entitled to this more than anyone. I was probably chosen for those things because I was a forward and social media and different things like that. But I didn't want the players to be looking at, like, and some players probably did kind of begrudge it, but they were looking at it saying, like, why are you doing this? Why are you going out on a solo run? Why are you trying to be commercial? Like, and I didn't want it to get it between the group. And there was times when it came up, like anything, social media came up, people post on social media, brand stuff, sponsorship stuff. It was the same stuff that came up when you're trying to have those conversations around how to be better. And I always fought back the cases, like, why wouldn't, like, and I don't think there was one massive pushback in the team, because there was loads to go around as well, as in, yeah, there was loads of opportunities. There's six sponsors of the football, and there's club sponsors and county sponsors and all types of stuff.
Was there ever any concern that it might be in the back of the selectors' heads? Like,
yeah, I don't know. It's very hard to say that it would be or wouldn't be. I'd say it probably was, as in the back of their minds, whether it was brought into the conversation around picking the team. I doubt it. As in my view, whether it was or wasn't, but I think that Jim, and he said himself, says he's no issues with commercial as long as you're producing on the pitch, knock yourselves out. That was his line, and which was fair enough. Yeah, was it? And I was still doing some when I was wasn't playing as much, because I was in contracts with different brands like that. But I'd say it definitely came across it. I'd like to think that wasn't the case. I'd like to think that the team was picked on the best ability of the players, albeit there's the unconscious bias we talked about what might come into things at times, but I'd like to think that was not a variable in it.
What about you, in terms of the pressure that it puts on you? Like,
I didn't think...
Was it just crack?
Yeah, I just enjoyed it. It was kind of probably... I came into it early because Alan was doing endorsements when I came into the team, and
right.
I was Alan's brother. I was naturally, here's his brother. This is a nice story.
One.
Two for one. In you go. So it's been always part of what I'd known. Yes, it ramped up and it got more serious, and there was more, like, TV and different things, different mediums like that. But it didn't ever throw me. Like, I never felt like I had to play better or score more because I had an endorsement deal, or I was wearing a certain pair of boots, or
yeah, because it's the old story about the double page spread on the morning of the All Ireland final. It was cursed for years, and then Lara Corbett did one and scored a hat trick in the All Ireland final. So it's not really connected in any way.
And we wouldn't read it. I wouldn't see it. We genuinely, none of that team, I'd say, would ever read a paper in All Ireland final. Back in the early days, I remember newspapers been around. DCU, where we used to, Pat's early years, I remember a couple of newspapers went around the mornings, you're hanging around for so long, but that was very quickly stopped.
Yeah.
And you get together so early in the day, and you're trained to kind of keep your mind pure.
Jim's style of play obviously evolved after the Donegal game. What's your recollection of the Donegal game, the before and after? Because with Paul Flynn sitting in that seat saying that it felt like we were saving football that year. And I could just imagine what the excitement was like, because you were all at your peak in one respect. That forward line, that generation of forwards, certainly that first 30 minutes against Donegal was savage.
Yeah, my memory is that we weren't flying, but I know we had big scores from Flinner and Dermo. And we were motoring quite well. We were finding it hard to get into our usual scoring zone. And I was having a tough day. They just were well organised, the team. They just well drilled. Jim, for fairness, he brought that team on a journey over a 4 or 5 year period that he really rallied them to be a great team. I have a lot of pain around that game. I take a lot of it on my shoulders. I missed 2 frees in the second half that I wouldn't normally miss. They were tough frees, but they were ones that I would, in years gone past, I would have scored. And I remember my only recollection is standing under the Cusack looking into the canal end and over a free and saying, I don't think I'm going to score this. And I'd never, ever felt like that. And I think it was after Ryan McHugh got a goal or whatever it was, but just the confidence was knocked out of me for whatever reason. I don't know why. And I stepped up to it and kicked it wide or whatever happened to it. And I just didn't feel confident that day. I don't know what it was. As much as Flinner, probably he had a great day and the different emotions, the different players, but I was never comfortable that day. I don't know why. And I was playing good football throughout the year. But maybe it was just a setup or just a lack of ball coming in as an inside forward line. Obviously, we'd had it in 2011. We'd met the team and got over the line in a gritty game.
Yeah.
That was dictated the way teams set up for the next 5 years. And eventually, I suppose, Dublin kind of figured out a way of breaking it down. But in 14, I never felt comfortable in the game. That's my overwriting when you say look back on it.
And again, it's a defeat that kind of spurs the 5 in a row, because the 5 in a row doesn't happen if you don't lose that. Like, you know, the defensive structure, the way that you started to control games, the basketball influence, all of that comes in. Is that immediately after that? Is it as stark as that?
I think we had to figure out a way. We worked hard on how to break down that mass defense. We worked very hard on that. And that we felt that was, over the next couple of years, that was going to be the solution here. And I felt like we did that well, and we felt that when we come up against that team, we were going to, the possession game was the way to do it, and wait for gaps and go for it. So that was what was worked on heavily, and we just felt, we felt if we could, we had the scoring prowess to beat any team, and if we could break down that mass defence that a lot of teams were taking on, we'd be hard to stop.
Yeah, because the insistence on this being like a Dublin style of play where we're going to win games and shootouts and we're going to be able to do that forever, that disappears. The it didn't matter after that. It was like, we need to become a winning machine. That's the way to win games.
Yeah.
Were they hard conversations to have? Or was it just obvious?
It was obvious that had to be done. Like, it took the joy out of the game a bit. Like, the Northern style football for an inside forward like me, it definitely wasn't as enjoyable a game. Like, I had some great games where I played well and didn't, but against the likes of Cork and Meath over the years, where you're marking your man and playing full forward, you're one on one, and you're taking the ball's been kicked, gets kick, kick, kick. Yes, some balls spray wide, some balls get lost in the play, but it's just up and down, up and down. I love that style of football. Whereas now, as I said, it's into possession, it's calm control. You don't kick the ball fast, but as those years went on, the inside forward line had to adapt.
Less crack,
absolutely less crack. Yeah, but you look at what a Mannion can do now when he's on song. He gets about, he works hard, he's on the full back line making blocks and saves, and he's up the other end getting on the end of stuff to get scores. So but you have to have a serious engine to do that and to be effective. So the game has just evolved, like any sport, any game. It evolves through analytics and through stats, and understanding that you have the ball more times than the other, you win more kickouts, you have better opportunity to win the game, and that's what it comes down to.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.